Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's Unified, U-N-I-F-Y-D, healing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE system.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
And welcome to In the Know, the Hornets 24/7 podcast. Your knowledgeable hosts are Michael McNamara.
Me and a grizzly bear, I'm betting on me.
And me, Ryan Schwan.
I've been playing some Dungeons & Dragons because I'm really cool like that.
Let's get it started. All Hornets, all the time.
Welcome to the show. The Hornets are undefeated since our last podcast. I don't think I've said that in, well, years. Michael, Eric Gordon, he's playing. Is Eric Gordon the reason why we won these two games?
Oh, you want to just go straight to that and already set me up so people can immediately write that I'm a hater in those comments?
You are a hater. You hate everybody.
It's such a tough question because I don't really know what question we're answering. Like, if you're saying, is he putting a team that is playing well enough to be really close over the top, I would say yes. I would say overall, though, you know, the 5-22 team, I think a lot of those players are gone. I think a lot of things have improved independent of Eric Gordon. And Eric Gordon has provided a little bit of a boost, but I would give more credit to, you know, the improved play of Vasquez, Aminu, the defensive rotations where even when Gordon is off the court, they're much better than they used to be. And it just seems like guys are understanding that. I would put the credit, I would give 25% of the credit to Eric Gordon, 75% to other players and circumstances. Do you completely disagree? Is your number higher, lower?
I would probably give 50% to Eric Gordon. Actually, I would give – actually, your number is right with the 25% that I was throwing at Eric Gordon there, really being just the idea that him on the court will allow this team to win and everybody playing that way.
Yeah, and I mean, to me, I don't think it's a diss to Eric Gordon to say it. What I'm saying is actually optimistic and kind of exciting because I'm not really giving Gordon much of the credit here because, quite frankly, I mean, he's not playing good basketball. He's putting up Austin Riverish type numbers, especially over the last four games. If you take away that Charlotte game against the worst defense in the NBA, I mean, your numbers to him in your article today were actually very generous because if you take away that Charlotte game, we're talking about 31% from the field, 7% from three, 13.5 points a game. I mean, he's been playing well below, you know, what he is capable of, and this team is still winning. So that to me is actually an exciting proposition, because if he gets back to being Eric Gordon and you add that to all the other things that I think are more responsible for this recent winning streak, to me, you know, the sky is the limit for a version of this healthy version of this team.
Yeah, I mean, if you take a look at the numbers in that piece, and I mean, there is a whole lot here that I didn't say in that piece because I didn't want it to be, you know, a Bill Simmons 6,000 word article. Because there's a lot of other things in there. Like, if you take a look at those numbers, Eric Gordon, yeah, his differential is really nice in the minutes that he's played. He's had a lot of different impacts on the team. But Jason Smith has just as big of an impact, and he came back at the same time. So it's basically both of them coming back has helped this team tremendously. Roger Mason during that stretch, because of course one quarter, has amazing numbers. And I don't think anybody here is going to say, well, Roger Mason is going to now save us every single game. It's just happened once. And it's five games, too. I mean, you can't look at five games and say anything about this, because there is going to be a lot of difference. Like, one of the things I didn't mention there, I really thought about it, was the Hornets had apparently the best free throw defense in the entire league at this time, because opponents shot like 66% while Eric Gordon was on the floor. And when he was off the floor, they shot like 78%.
And that, I mean, exactly. That's what I'm saying is, to me, I mean, I think we all understand the difference between correlation and causation. And to me, there's a lot more correlation going on where, yeah, Eric Gordon is back and yes, we are winning. But I feel that it's somewhat disrespectful to the other players who I think have improved, and not just because Eric Gordon's presence is there or because he's on the court with them. Like, so, I, you know, a thing that I've been seeing a lot is, well, Al-Farouq Aminu's playing really well because he's playing next to Eric Gordon and, you know, now he fits there and yada, yada, yada. But if you look over these last six games at Aminu's stats when Gordon is off the court, they're actually better than when he's playing with Gordon. I mean, he's shooting over 44% when Gordon is on the bench. He's shooting only 31% when Gordon is on the court. He's rebounding at a higher clip when Gordon is off the court. He's assisting at over 300% higher when Gordon is off the court than when he's on. I mean, really the only thing that Aminu is doing better offensively when Gordon is on the court is limiting his turnovers, which, you know, makes sense to us. But I guess what I just don't feel is correct and what I think is unfair to other players is saying, oh, you know, they're playing well because Eric Gordon is back, when Vasquez is similar as well. I mean, he's playing very well in these last couple of games, even when Gordon is on the bench. So I just don't think it's fair to attribute all this success to Gordon when other guys are playing really well, and it has nothing to do with Gordon. I mean, Jason Smith barely plays with Gordon, but he's starting to play well again now that it seems like he's more healthy. He's starting to hit those jumpers again. So I just think there's a lot of factors. I'm not trying to hate on Gordon by saying that he's not the, you know, the biggest reason why this winning streak is here, obviously upgrading from one of the worst shooting guards in the league at starter to now a guy who's playing a little below average offensively and exceptional defensively. Obviously, that's part of the reason why you go from a team losing games to a team winning games. But I just feel like so many other guys are playing much better basketball, even when Gordon is on the bike, on the bench. Wow, Freudian slip, or on the stationary bike.
Well, I mean, you mentioned it, though. I mean, I think the difference in offense from before Gordon played and after he came back is, you know, 2-3 points per 100 possessions. And, I mean, we know that that can be swung wildly over the course. I mean, if you remember back to, like, the first six games of the season, the Hornets were one of the best defensive teams in the league because people weren't hitting their three-point shots. And then when that became normal, suddenly the Hornets were the worst. So that can swing pretty quickly because of the small number of games we're talking about. Of, you know, 3 points is one shot every 100 possessions. But the defense has swung a lot more wildly. And you mentioned it, that Gordon is an exceptional defender. I think that that has a lot to do with why this team is playing so much better. Basically, before we had, you know, a B perimeter defender in Aminu and a bunch of C, at best, if I'm being nice, perimeter defenders, probably, you know, Austin Rivers is a D. Vasquez may be a D, probably is a D. Now, of course, you have two Bs out there if Eric Gordon's not better than B. I mean, so I was pretty impressed with some of the stuff he was doing against Houston. Suddenly, a B player is not matched up with an A offensive player, and a D isn't matched up against a B offensive player. They're kind of matching up head-to-head. And you can just see, I mean, the biggest number, the biggest difference between the Hornets before Gordon and the Hornets after Gordon was that defensive rebounding. And you're kind of like, well, that can't be Gordon, because, of course, Gordon doesn't rebound. He doesn't grab rebounds to save. I mean, he doesn't even try. But when you are able to defend on the perimeter, your big men are no longer having to help out so much, and they're actually getting in position. And, I mean, even Lopez has turned into a halfway decent rebounder while Gordon's on the floor, defensive rebounder, where he wasn't at all. I'm not saying, I mean, they're both, Lopez has been playing with more fire, so I'm not going to give him all the credit, I mean, Gordon all the credit, but I think it helps. So that combined with the fact that I think these guys just feel right now, hey, we actually can win these games, I think is just all the world difference in this team right now.
Yeah, and that's the immeasurable. I mean, that's something that you either believe in or you don't. I mean, this was, again, to go to football, the argument for Tim Tebow is he just gave his teammates a belief, these intangibles that you can't really measure, and that's why the Broncos won all those games last year. I mean, I don't know. I don't feel like I can make the argument for or against all these, his presence and tangibles. You know, the team feels like they could win again. I don't really feel like taking the time to discuss that because it's unprovable either way. But I mean, what I will say is, yeah, the defense has gotten better, but the defensive rating when Gordon is off the court in these last six games has also gotten way better. And so to me, again, do you give Gordon the credit for that? I guess if you were stretching to give him the credit, you would say, well, yeah, because now Rivers is covering the second string as opposed to, I don't know, making Roger Mason do it. And it's a trickle-down effect where guys are sliding into positions and roles. But just, again, by the eye test, when Gordon is off the court, do you see the hellacious breakdowns that we used to see? Do you see when he steps off the court, just guys wide open? I don't. So again, is it correlation or causation? Like, you know, we were told that it takes about 20 to 30 games to understand a defensive system and get into a flow. You know, were the guys starting to get into that anyway and Gordon just makes it better? Or is Gordon the one fixing everything? Because again, how do you give him credit when he is off the floor and you're not having those defensive breakdowns and you know, your defensive rating goes up when Eric Gordon is on the stationary bike? I don't know how he gets credit for that also.
No, he shouldn't get credit for that. I think the reason why our bench is playing so well is you got Jason Smith and you got Lance Thomas on that unit. And you're not spot minuting Lance Thomas into the starting unit where he's even then outmatched. Now he's going up against other flawed players. Jason Smith is energy. I mean, he can't rebound the ball, but he's pure energy defensively, and he just, you know, he makes nothing easy.
Yeah.
So
yeah, again, I don't want this to seem like, you know, I'm saying, to me, something positive. This team, all these guys are playing much better, and Eric Gordon is not even half of himself offensively yet. If this team is playing this well and winning now with, you know, I mean, to me, Eric Gordon has been a below-average shooting guard offensively since his return. If he gets back to his level, you know, and these guys are playing the way they're playing with and without him, this team, I mean, will be able to be competitive with all but maybe two or three teams in this league on a night-to-night basis.
Yeah. So let's actually talk games then. So the first game since the last podcast was the Spurs game. And you thought they were going to win this game, and I thought they were going to lose this game. And clearly you were right, and I was wrong.
Oh, you're just setting me up so you could say the same thing about the Rockets, but okay, go ahead.
So, how did you know that? Hey. So, I mean, there's just one thing that leaps out of me about this game. There's one reason why the Hornets won this game. They had 10 more shots.
Yeah, and we talked about this, and this was, if you go back to the podcast, a huge reason why I thought the Hornets could win this game, because the Spurs just really don't try to rebound on the offensive end. And actually, they did a fairly decent job in stretches where, you know, again, you said what their offensive rebounding strategy was a couple podcasts ago, and you know, Splitter and Duncan on different occasions were able to beat, you know, two or three Hornets to the offensive rebound and collect it by themselves. So they were able to, but for the most part, the Spurs don't really crash the offensive boards. And as great as the Spurs record is, even in the two games without Eric Gordon, those two contests were incredibly close because I just feel like it's a great matchup for the Hornets. I feel like the only place where they're at a distinct disadvantage is at the point guard position. And, you know, Eric Gordon had one terrific stretch in this game. I mean, I would say, again, he was below average offensively for most of the night. He had a tremendous stretch in this game, and that stretch helped propel the Hornets, you know, again, put them over the top, because this is a matchup where without Eric Gordon, the Hornets lose by two at home. With Eric Gordon, you know, they're put over the top and they win by seven. So I don't know. I like the matchup, and I was super impressed with Aminu in this game.
Yeah, and I mean, people who would look at his stat line, they're going to be wondering how you could possibly say that. 4 points, 10 rebounds, 3 assists, 3 steals, 1 block, 5 turnovers, 2 fouls. I mean, all of the weaknesses we've complained about Aminu, they still exist. He still has no offensive game. He didn't score very much, and he turned the ball over way too much.
You know what my favorite stat?
Explain why you loved it.
My favorite stat, of that entire box score, my favorite part is the 5 field goal attempts. Yeah. And one of those was at the end of the shot clock, so I don't really, you know, where he had to fling it, so I don't really count it. But the fact that he stayed within his game, I think when we talk a little bit more in the Rockets game, he tried to go outside of what he was good at, and that's what I have problems with. But yeah, the turnovers were frustrating, but to me, the fact that, you know, he only took 5 shots, and the guys who, you know, deserved to get the shots, got them. Is why I was happy. And just the off-ball defense, his rotations, he wasn't lost. And, you know, of course, the rebounds, which led to what you said at the beginning, 10 more shots for the Hornets than the Spurs.
Yeah, I mean, the Spurs only dragged down. I mean, you said Tim Duncan was grabbing a couple offensive rebounds, but the Spurs rebounded essentially like 22%, which is a bad number. There's no way you can get to that. And the Hornets were at over 33% offensive rebounding. And Aminu didn't even grab any of those offensive rebounds, but I still came away from that game thinking, wow, Aminu's just – he was – leaping in the air, reaching way out over people to drag in those rebounds and fighting for them. And I mean, it was just, it was a joy to watch Aminu playing like that.
So let me, I don't mean to be Debbie Downer. I just want to be as objective as possible. Hornets win this game by 7. Game is pretty close throughout. One thing that was hard not to notice during the game and is hard not to notice in the box scores. Manu Ginobili gets 25 minutes. Duncan gets 26 minutes. Parker, 33 minutes. If this is a game, if this is a playoff game, or a game that the Spurs need to win, if this isn't in the middle of a long, grueling NBA season where we know the Spurs, you know, tend to limit minutes, do those guys play, you know, those same amount of minutes? And I guess what I'm getting to is any small thing taken away from this victory because of, you know, that fact?
I would say that the Spurs were going at about 85%. And particularly Popovich with his decisions. But, I mean, I will say that he benched Tim Duncan when Duncan missed 5 straight shots and Duncan never came back. And it was kind of like you could just see him thinking, you know, Duncan's playing out like really hard out there. There's not a lot of whistles being blown. Let him get a breather. He's not being super effective. Let's see if my other guys can win. And that's part of the genius of Popovich is he always gives his other guys chances to win. I mean, that's why they're so capable, because he puts them in situations like this and trusts them. And they know that he trusts them. So, I mean, but you're right. I mean, there is no way, especially, you know, Tim Duncan is going to be playing only 26 minutes when a game really, really matters.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not trying to take anything away. I'm just trying to project to the future. I don't think we could get too happy about the Charlotte win,
but
happy about the Dallas win. You know, I kind of expected this one, and they limited the minutes. So, again,
I do want to point something out, though. How many minutes did Anthony Davis play?
Okay, we'll get to that. I don't know if he deserves more.
Okay.
I don't think that's a case of limiting minutes over the long, grueling season the way Popovich, as much as based on some 5-man combinations we've been seeing lately, Anthony Davis doesn't deserve to get more minutes than that. So
okay.
So
you want to talk Anthony Davis?
Yeah.
And this is the thing that I thought was – I read the AP recap of this game, and they acted like Anthony Davis was a dominating figure in this game, that, like, he was – this was a great game for him, that he was one of the major reasons why the Hornets won, other than Eric Gordon's stretch in the fourth. And I walked away from this game thinking that he played a nice game. I didn't walk away thinking that, wow, Anthony Davis was the best player on the court.
No, but you got to remember, it's a society that loves highlight reel clips. So, you know, he had, I mean, Jason Smith goes a very efficient 4-for-4. You're not going to see any of his stuff on SportsCenter or as a photo in that AP story. But Anthony Davis, I think, makes plays that you remember longer and more vividly. So based on that, people tend to remember. I mean, you got to know how horrible the human memory is, you know, and they tend to remember him that way. But no, I feel the same way as you. I thought he had a nice game, a lot of activity.
And he didn't back down to Duncan at all. I mean, I'll give him that 100% credit. I mean,
yeah.
He was going hard against Duncan.
But it still feels like, I mean, there were stretches. There was a stretch where the game was starting to get away from San Antonio that they just gave the ball to Duncan and he got, you know, a shot and an and one opportunity. And it was just so easy for him. Like, you feel like he knows that he could score on Anthony Davis anytime he wants. And I mean, he should be able to just because of the, you know, the basketball IQ and, you know, his experience. But you still have this feeling that, you know, if they go to Duncan in the post and Davis is on him getting no help, Duncan will be able to do almost anything he wants. It's just a matter of whether his shot is on or off that night. And in a lot of instances, Duncan was just off in this game.
Yeah. So, I mean, was there anything particular about Anthony Davis in the game that you, I mean, have seen that was different from what we've seen from him all year?
Just energy and activity. Like, I can't make any complaints about, you know, him walking or standing around or, you know, just watching the ball. Like, I felt like the activity and energy was there. And, you know, maybe it was a conversation with Monty letting him know that we're back to full health now. And so you're only going to play, you know, 25 to 28 minutes. So go at it full speed. You'll get plenty of rest. I don't know. But the energy was noticeable. I mean, did you feel that, or did you feel he still had lackadaisical stretches, or was just on an energy standpoint, did you feel like you were satisfied with this performance?
Yeah, I didn't have any of the moments where I was like, why is he not rotating?
Right.
I mean, there were games before where I was just like, you know, if I actually would think to myself, if he's going to play that way, he doesn't deserve to be on the court at all. Which then I'd be like, oh, wow, I'm saying that about my number one draft pick. I never had even a moment where I was watching the game thinking that, you know, he wasn't doing what he was supposed to be doing, or at least trying to do what he was supposed to be doing. Because, you know, they're a tough team even when their shots aren't falling that well.
Yeah, and I mean, so again, Ryan Anderson, another one where if somebody didn't watch this game and look at the stat line, they're starting to wonder where Ryan Anderson's game is going. I mean, we're at 1 point per shot in this game. Gets a couple of rebounds, but per minute, you know, especially on the defensive boards, not that impressive. What did you feel walking away from this game with Rhino?
I thought that his at any time, he makes the team's offense run because he's just being on the floor and being that guy. They had to do the same thing to Peja back in 2007 and 8, where they just basically had to take one of their guys and say, sit on them and don't ever leave him. And here's the difference between Anderson and Peja. When they did that to Peja, Peja scored like 8 points and wouldn't get any threes off. When they do it to Ryan Anderson, he still finds his spots. So, I mean, and also Anderson wasn't getting any calls. I mean, he was working so hard to get some of those shots in the mid-range area, and they were all over him, and he just couldn't get a call. And that's been like a prevailing issue for a few games. When we get to Houston, holy cow! But this game, there's still the same sort of problems. And I mean, I don't know what I can say about that any longer. I mean, Ryan Anderson, it's almost because he's a sort of a finesse player. The refs just feel like he's trying to avoid the contact, so he doesn't deserve that. When he does get contact, he gets the calls. I don't know. I mean, I'm going to just bring up something about Ryan Anderson. This irked me. So Ryan Anderson is a team's leading scorer, really. I mean, is Eric Gordon still above him? No, I think Eric Gordon has fallen below him now. So Ryan Anderson is the team's leading scorer. Can you name any leading scorer in the NBA on a team who, in a official recap of that team's games, they would call that guy the team's three-point specialist?
Hmm.
And in the last recap, the one against Houston, where, of course, he didn't hit any shots at all, they said that's how they described him. Ryan Anderson's the three-point specialist for the Hornets was unable to hit a shot. I'm like, he's not the three-point specialist. He is our leading scorer. He is the primary scorer on this team.
Right. Yeah, I mean,
it just annoys me. The conception of Ryan Anderson is just not at all in line with the reality.
Yeah, and that's why when we get to my ideal future, the national media never covers a game again. But, yeah, I completely agree, and he has added a lot to his game, and you just keep wondering what's going to happen when he gets the respect we feel he deserves from the refs, but maybe that never comes. But yeah, I think he did better than his stat line showed. And I guess my question goes back to what you said about even when he's not on, he's such a floor spacer that teams have to respect that he opens things up for other people. You and I don't really care and have never cared about who the starting five is. We care about the finishing five. Is there any circumstance, if Ryan Anderson is healthy, that you can imagine that in a close game, Ryan Anderson is not part or should not be part of the finishing five?
No. No, I mean, even if Robin Lopez is having one of his lights-out offensive nights, I would rather have Anthony Davis sit down in favor of Ryan Anderson in that situation, which is what usually happens.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess it's possible that if Lopez is having one of his incredibly crazy offensive nights and there's nothing they're able to do to stop him, which happens every once in a while, and that's I just for a second, I never thought I would ever say that about Robin Lopez. And Jason Smith is absolutely required for his defensive abilities because he's been getting crunch time minutes recently. Then possibly, but even then, it makes sense to put him in as a floor spacer at small forward. So, I mean, I mean, it would be a rare situation where Ryan Anderson would not be a closer for this team.
Yeah, I think you said it exactly right. You've got to have him on the court, even if some other guys are hot, just because, I mean, you try to keep those hot guys on the court, but yeah, even if Jason Smith has been drilling all his mid-range jumpers and, you know, Robin Lopez is having one of those 8-for-9 games in the post, one of them has to come out for Ryan Anderson. You know, whoever you choose, I guess, would depend on the matchup. But to me, when Eric Gordon is healthy, he is 100% of the time in that closing five. Ryan Anderson is the only other guy to me, you know, on this team that's a lock. And I say that because, I mean, Vasquez is close, but if he is off that night and you need shooting, I could see a Gordon-Mason backcourt, you know, and you need the rebounding of Aminu so you can only go with two guards. I mean, Vasquez is next in line for me, but for me, the two locks that 100% of the time you have to have in that closing five in a close game are Gordon and Anderson.
Yeah. There is one thing I want to challenge you on.
Uh-oh.
And you said essentially that the one position that the Hornets are at a clear disadvantage at was at point guard. And in general, yes, Tony Parker's a better player than Grievous Vasquez. But in this game, did you feel like Tony Parker was running wild?
I get not as much as the other ones. I mean, again, this was a weird game for me. Like, I never, not to take anything away from our guys, but I never really felt that San Antonio really had the pedal to the metal and were trying to take this game. Parker had an odd game. I mean, 10 turnovers for him and Duncan combined is just odd, especially against the Hornets, who really don't turn people over. So I can't say that, you know, we should get a ton of credit for that. They were just a little disoriented in this game. I felt like, I honestly did, yes, feel like Parker could have scored whenever he wanted to, but there wasn't a lot of that getting into the lane and finding guys for wide open shots. And even when he did, they missed. I mean, Danny Green goes 0 for 5 in this game, 0 for 4 from deep. And those shots weren't all, you know, contested. It was just, you know, an off night, I think, that the Hornets benefited from. But, yeah, I felt like Parker could have scored at will. But, no, I don't think overall I would say he wreaked havoc.
So I brought that up because before the game, in our last podcast, I said the one thing I wanted to see was the Hornets stop Parker from that one play where he does a little weave, goes across the top of the paint, then cuts under and does the layup across the glass while no one could stop him. First time he tried that play, Anthony Davis stepped out, drove him away from the paint, and made him circle back around and reset.
Mm-hmm.
I was extraordinarily happy. I was just like, I mean, it's the exact same play. I was like, oh, he's scoring right here. And he had to circle back out again. And I was like, yay! And then, of course, you know, I think he then hit a jumper. But
I want to see one of these giddy little clips of yours on YouTube. I mean, like, we see all the ones where the team wins the Super Bowl. They tape the father screaming and crying or whatever. Like, can your kids operate a camera? Because I want one of these Schwann giddy little moments.
Yeah, I think you'd be disappointed. I'm usually sitting there in my underwear late at night watching on TiVo.
Why would I be disappointed then? yeah, so, I mean, Vasquez, I think, played under control for the most part.
Yeah, nice game. I mean, 14 and 11, he had three turnovers, but they weren't, I mean, like we said, the number one thing Eric Gordon allows him to do is not have to be under the high-pressure attack moments. So he's able to pick his moments, get a couple early offense attacks where he got nice point, nice things. If he fails on his first attempt, he can give it to Gordon and back off. He doesn't have to try again and then try again. It's just such a different dynamic with him out there having a release valve that he can rely on. It was just a nice game from him.
Yeah, and I mean, it's nice. I mean, in this matchup, Parker obviously has the quickness advantage, but Vasquez had the size, and he really used it, especially on the offensive end in this game when he got to the basket. I mean, Parker really can't contest any of his shots, and, you know, he was able to get that floater off with ease without having to bank it too high. I mean, I think Vasquez did what he needed to do to come as close to a draw as possible in this game with a guy who, you know, for my money over the last 2 years has been one of the top 8 to 10 players in the NBA. So, you know, I'll take that every time.
Yeah. So let's move to the next game, which may be the weirdest game we'll see all year. The referees, they didn't swallow their whistles. I don't think they brought their whistles to the game. I mean, they were.
And when they did, it was on the most random stuff.
Right. There were people getting mugged and getting no calls. And first off, I need to say this. It was on both ends of the court. 100%. Both sides were getting mugged left and right, and nobody was calling anything. Then there would be, like, silly little touch fouls every once in a while that got called, and you're like, really? Did you not watch the last play? Because you didn't call a guy getting hit in the head with a fist.
Yeah.
So it was the strangest game I've ever
watched.
Right,
and then James Harden takes a jump shot, and Rivers doesn't touch him. He's just in the shooter's area.
Right.
So he gets a foul. Like, forget about the guy who got clobbered in the face. Austin Rivers was in this guy's space, so he gets the foul. Yeah, it was so inconsistent and just an odd game overall. I mean, that's got to be such a frustrating game for players to play, and I was shocked that there weren't multiple technicals in that game.
Yeah, I mean, and you could just look at the free throw numbers. I mean, James Harden is a guy who averages 11 free throws a game. Eric Gordon is a guy who averages 7 free throws a game. And they combined to take 8.
Right.
And both of them weren't playing differently. They were both driving freely. So, I don't know. But Jake said, if anyone went to you and said, Ryan Anderson is going to score 0 points and Eric Gordon is going to shoot 2 of 12 and get 5 for you, and you're going to win the game, would you not just laugh them out of the room?
I would say that there was a small chance, but I would have left open the opportunity of pretty much exactly what happened. And again, I do not want to take the shine off these victories. You know, I'm just waiting for, you know, a larger sample size, but I mean, okay, I'll try to take this and make people, if they're going to be subjective about it, be subjective on the other side. So if the Hornets had just played a game the night before and their two best or two of their most athletic, best, whatever players had played 42 minutes and 39 minutes in a game in L.A. against L.A. the night before, in which they scored 125, ran up and down the court, and then, you know, they play the next night. And to me, there's no coincidence that Houston loses that fourth quarter 29-10. I mean, what is more logical? Houston comes out and, you know, beats New Orleans again in the third quarter, which everybody does to New Orleans at home. And then all of a sudden, New Orleans wins the fourth quarter 29-10. Is it more logical? I mean, if you had to bet on one over the other, would you say that something just clicked for the Hornets and all of a sudden they figured out how to play these guys, got hot, and Houston turned cold? Or that Houston, having played their starters significant minutes the night before in a game where the pace was 100 miles an hour, traveled in the second night of a back-to-back, that their legs went out in the fourth quarter and the Hornets pulled away? I mean, is that at least a possibility for why we saw such a dramatic shift in this game?
Sure. Yeah, I won't disagree. But, I mean, I would have, if I had been told that, I would have just assumed Ryan, if it hadn't been told Ryan Anderson scored zero, I would assume Ryan Anderson just got hot from three. And in this situation, it was Roger Mason getting hot from three. I mean, or one step inside from three, because he was hitting a lot of long twos. And I mean, we've actually seen this from Roger Mason. And the thing I wanted to say about Roger Mason is Monty did exactly what he needed to do. All of his guys who were shooting, whose shooters were failing him. Eric Gordon wasn't hitting his threes. Ryan Anderson wasn't hitting his threes. Brian Roberts missed both of his. Austin Rivers missed all three of his, and there were some wide open ones in all that set. It wasn't like Houston was doing a very good job of contending them. So he's just like, well, I need a person to stretch the floor. They still have to guard Ryan Anderson, and they will, but I need another person out there who might actually hit something. Tries out Roger Mason, and Mason goes nuts. That's what you do. That's why you have shooters on your bench.
I just got to stop you because you left off a significant name. Al-Farouq Aminu was airballing his 14-foot wide-open jumpers as well.
That's true.
I mean, he was having one of his rare off nights.
Rare?
Yeah. I mean, gosh. Teams just leave him wide. And these weren't 18, 19, 20-footers. I mean, these were at or inside the free throw line.
Yeah, he would drive, and I don't understand it at all, because Aminu's a good free throw shooter. So why can he not hit a jumper from the free throw line?
I mean, that just proves to you it's completely mental at that point.
I mean, if he was any other player, I would like every shot he took in that game almost. I think there's one I didn't like. They were all nice, open jumpers, well, not under too much pressure. He just can't hit them.
So you've been watching the Hornets for quite a while now. Has there been a bigger tease in the history of Hornets basketball than Al-Farouq Aminu? I mean, a guy who teases you with so many great attributes that you just want to buy in and then shows you as the reality with just amazingly poor specific skills when it comes to shooting and ball handling and in some cases decision making. I mean, has there been anybody that's just that much of a tease where you want to believe, and then they just find a way to break your heart?
Well, I mean, the obvious reference, and especially for me, was Julian Wright.
But did he show the great, I mean, Aminu at least?
His rookie season, if you go look at the numbers and how he played that first season, let me put it this way. I thought so much of him after that rookie season when I bought NBA 2K 2008, 2K8. I went in, edited his stats, and gave him a potential of A+, and then worked on him because I played with my buddy, and we had like three whole seasons of games for those Hornets. And I worked on him, and he was like an 88 by the time I was done with him.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, he was an amazing basketball player in that thing. But, yeah, I thought a lot of Julian Wright. Huh. But before that, let me think. I wouldn't know. I'm not at Al-Farouq. I'm in his level.
Yeah.
Do you have someone in mind?
I really don't. I mean, to me, he's the biggest. I mean, even Julian Wright, like, he had a stretch of about 20 good games in his rookie year where he played limited minutes and showed the ability.
He was shooting 41% from downtown. He would get like a couple assists, a couple steals, right. A couple blocks.
He did multiple things above average.
Yep.
But to me, Aminu's such a tease because he does some things that sometimes at an elite level. I mean, he could be one of the top, you know, right there with LeBron James, I would say the second best rebounding small forward in the NBA. Like, yeah. That's super elite. So he could do that. His off-the-ball defense, when he plays with energy because of his length and his quickness and the ability to disrupt passing lanes and help defend, to me, is super elite. So, like, the tease part to me is that because there are parts of his game that are elite to super elite, and then, you know, you want to just say, okay, well, give me average or unnoticeable everywhere else, and I could plug and play you, but he just gives you way below mediocre. I can't imagine that if however many people, you know, the people listening to this podcast, if I took any random five people and gave them 3 14-foot open jump shots, that they would miss as badly as Aminu. Anybody yeah. listening to this podcast right now, I can't believe that even just a random person who works at CVS would miss that shot worse. So that, to me, is what is so, you know, just crazy and why, he's just the biggest tease in Hornets history.
And at the same time, in the recap, that was the focus for me on Aminu, was he's terrible shooting, he had too many turnovers. But on the defensive end in this Houston game, he was disruptive, unbelievably disruptive. He was everywhere, tipping. It was great to watch when he was out there.
Okay.
So, I mean, I'm torn. I'm like, if the other guys are sucking up all the shots, do I care that he misses three jumpers really badly? Because he gives me so much else that's pretty solid?
Yeah, but I just say, please just don't take the shot. I don't care how open you are. Like, I know that's got to be, you know, that's got to kill the confidence of an NBA player, but I want so badly to just say that. Like, I would rather the shot clock expire. Because at least then you're not going to have a horrible miss that could lead to transition. Like, the team has to play it, take it out of bounds and set up in there, and you could set up in your half-court defense. Like, honestly, his shooting is so bad, I would prefer shot clock violations. That's not even a joke. Honestly, strategy-wise, would you prefer, I mean, the other team has, on average, about a 78% chance of rebounding Aminu's miss. So, yeah, you have a 22% chance at an offensive rebound, and from there, a good chance of scoring whatever. Versus if he misses, it could lead to, you know, to easy transition. Like, I would honestly prefer the shot clock violation, but just for...
I think you're going a little overboard for me, but
okay.
I understand why you're going there.
Okay, so just for... This is for Steve Ruiz. Could you give me the full name of the player that we are talking about right now?
Al-Farouq Aminu?
Okay. Sorry, he just likes the way that you pronounce Al-Farouq's name. So he had a special request. I asked for questions and comments and things for us to discuss on Twitter. He wanted you to say that name.
Now I'm self-conscious about it. Am I saying it wrong?
Aminu.
Al-Farouq Aminu.
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 Not Aminu. But anyway. So in this game, I mean, so I think the first thing that you notice, whether you're watching the game or you didn't catch it, and just looked at the box scores, is of our four bigs that we talk about all the time, even with one of them scoring 0 points, going 0 for 7 from the field, Anthony Davis, by, you know, gets some of his lowest minutes of the year, and only gets 19 minutes in this game. I mean, what do you think of what we've seen recently from the big man rotation?
I think that Anthony Davis took a seat because Jason Smith was playing better than him. And I don't have a problem with it. I really don't. I mean, this is the people I've seen people get kind of annoyed by this rotations of Monty that, you know, Anthony Davis, he's the future of the team. He deserves to get all the minutes he can to develop. I don't actually believe that if you get a guy, give a guy 34 minutes a game, every single game through their rookie season, that they're guaranteed any more stardom than a guy who gets 20 minutes some game and 30 minutes another game based on how well he's playing. I mean, the number one guy that pops into mind, Deron Williams. I mean, Deron Williams, his rookie season, he didn't play more than like 15 minutes for half of it. He was behind nobody. I mean, there wasn't any great point guard in front of him, and he slowly figured it out, and he became a superstar. And this is like really the standard way players usually enter the league. They're not Chris Paul. They don't come in and are incredible from day one. And Anthony Davis is playing as a big man in a man's league where he doesn't have his full growth yet. I don't have any problem with him getting 19 minutes a game as long as there are games where he's playing well and he gets 30 minutes, which we saw in other situations. So I don't have a problem with him getting 19 minutes. I didn't watch him this game and think, wow, he's having a huge impact. Defensively, he had some nice moments, but offensively, he wasn't getting anything done.
Yeah, and I mean, the thing that makes me worry even less is that it seems like Anthony Davis is fine with it too, and by fine, I don't mean he's happy with it, but he's not sulking. I mean, if you look at any of those big minutes and moments in that game, and especially with Roger Mason going crazy from three, the guy that's easiest to see on the bench waving his towel, going crazy, and being a cheerleader is Anthony Davis. Like, he's not sitting there sulking, feeling bad for himself. He is excited to be a part of this team, excited to be a part of winning, and he's just going to be that much, you know, more amped up and play with that much more energy when he does get on the court.
Right. I mean, there was a stretch of like 3 minutes in the fourth quarter where he wasn't even on the bench. He had like kind of edged around to the baseline of the court and was like, you know, right on the edge of it, kind of dancing. And I kept thinking, you know, it's possible he might land a technical for himself because he's not supposed to be on the court and he's kind of getting into it. So, I mean, yeah, he was 100% behind everything that's happening in the game when he wasn't playing a minute. Big grins. I mean, it was. I think Monty's doing a good job with Anthony Davis.
And I mean, Jason Smith, 17 points, 6 offensive rebounds, 10 total. I mean, had maybe his best offensive game of the season, if not one of the top three. I know had a great one against the Clippers, but could you make an argument that he had as big of an impact on the defensive end?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's why I think he was on the floor so much, was because of his pick and roll defense. He was moving his feet so well out there. And I mean, I don't think Asik had run into a guy who could match him with size and energy. And of course he also made Asik have to actually come out of the paint. Asik wants to stay back and block shots, and Asik was not willing to come out and guard Jason Smith's jumper. So he was making him pay on both ends of the floor. Jason Smith was our best player on the team in this game, even with Roger Mason getting hot for a quarter.
Ryan, I love doing these podcasts with you. I could just always bank on a laugh. After the first time you said Asik, I was going to correct you, but I'm like, you know, he's not going to say it again. I think people could rewind the podcast. I think he managed to say it somehow 6 times in 15 seconds. It's a chic.
Asik.
Ah! All right. I love it. You make me laugh. I think I love the way Smith played, but yeah, the defensive rotation. I will take you. I will challenge you on one thing that you said. I mean, you didn't fully say it, but to me, it sounded like you kind of implied it. Austin Rivers was 0 for 5 in this game. From what I saw, I mean, factually, he took three of those shots when the shot clock was at two or lower. Mm-hmm. The ball basically came into his hand. He had to shoot it. I guess when I'm watching this game, to me, he is 100% determined to be playing point guard on this team. The only time I could remember him looking for his shot, and this is maybe the worst possible thing that could happen, he drives to the basket, gets the half a step, lays it up, misses the shot. It just goes in and out. He falls to the ground. Patterson gets the rebound and steps on him, thereby falling as well, and the foul is called on Rivers. So yeah. Not only does he miss the shot and fall down, but now he gets a foul because he gets stepped on. But just overall, you know, I felt like he was 100% determined to be point guard in this game, and even in the San Antonio game before it, you know, just look for opportunities to drive and dish and just really not looking for his shot at all. Did you see the same thing? And if so, do you think that this is good or bad for his long-term development?
I don't know if it's good or bad for his long-term development. I find it fascinating. I think that he is passing up opportunities to score that he shouldn't be. But I'm also wondering if he's doing that because his ability to score is so far beyond below his ability to get opportunities to score. I mean, there are times where they swing the ball to him where, I mean, he has a clear advantage when he catches, and he just kind of looks around for somebody else to pass to. I mean, I don't know. I think Austin Rivers is struggling mentally now more than he was at the beginning of the season.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's tough. Because it's hard. It's hard to tell somebody to shoot more and for them to believe it when it's so obvious that there are better and more efficient scorers on the court at that time. You know what I mean?
Hmm.
Almost logically, it doesn't make sense. Like, why wouldn't I look to gain an advantage to get the ball to somebody who right now in their career is a better shooter and scorer? So I could kind of see Rivers' logic of, you know, I'm going to create for others because, you know, they have a better ability right now to put the ball through the bucket. But yeah, I don't know what's better long term. Like, I guess if I'm being as optimistic as possible, he's working on his point guard game in games. And in practice, he's just working on his shooting and scoring with the hope that he could develop it there. So then, you know, when it finally does click, it could all come together and he could have the ability to score while now on the job have learned how to be a point guard. That to me is the most optimistic best case scenario. But yeah, there is also a scenario of, he is just going to get gun shy and, you know, he's going to look to become a true point guard and never be good enough at that to really be able to make up for his lack of ability to score. So, yeah, I could see it, as always with Austin Rivers, going either way, but I think it's obvious now he's looking to set up as opposed to looking for his own shot.
Yeah. We need to mention Vasquez in this game. 17 points, 4 rebounds, 11 assists. He only took 13 shots. He had 3 steals, but he also had 4 turnovers. They weren't really awful turnovers. I mean, there wasn't like any moment where I was like, that's just a really dumb thing. I think he had one pass where I kind of wondered why he tried. But I mean, the thing about Vasquez, he has become more and more impressive with his ability to score, going towards the basket and, you know, being defended and having a guy clearly between him, and he can still hit shots over them while on the move. And it makes me wonder, you know, when people talk about, like, really great teams, like, I watched the Celtics back with Larry Bird. And they talk about the big three there of Larry Bird, Kevin McHale, and Robert Parrish. And I think no one ever talks about Parrish. And the reason why they never talk about Parrish is because he was the workhorse who scored through the middle of the game, and was, you know, their first option on plays being done at the end of the second quarter, at the beginning of the second. He was basically, he played long minutes and he got 20 points a game, and he was never like, wow, that's an amazing guy, he needs to be like the star of any sort of team, but he still got you 20 points a game when, you know, an era when you got 120 per game. And, you know, I almost feel like Vasquez could be that kind of guy for you. Like, he's not going to be spectacular, but when the game is just grinding it out, when you're just got those possessions through the middle of the game where everybody's starting to feel a little tired and Vasquez can hit those shots over guys, I mean, it's just as valuable to have a guy who can get you a nice, steady 13 to 17 points a game in a slow game like this as, you know, having Eric Gordon at the end who can finish it for you.
Yeah, I mean, without that game being in striking distance, Roger Mason getting hot really doesn't matter.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, I could see that with Vasquez. I also, not to go so quickly away from Vasquez and could come back, but I see something kind of similar in a way in Robin Lopez. I haven't found a way to search this yet. Maybe you could do it at some point. Maybe one of our listeners knows how to do this. But if you had to bet, wouldn't you think that Robin Lopez scores, I don't know, maybe 70% of his points in the first 20 minutes of games?
Yeah.
Doesn't it feel like that? I mean, and the guy that I remember doing this a lot for a good team was Josh Howard. Josh Howard would kind of just be the workhorse in those first quarters. You know, then he would fade away. He didn't really have the game to get his own shot late in games, whatever. But getting all those points and keeping Dirk fresh and Jason Terry, you know, because Dallas didn't start Terry, so their first unit wasn't great offensively. Then Terry would come in and provide that boost. But that had a lot of value to it. And what you're saying is, about Vasquez is, yeah, if you could have Lopez as that workhorse in the first quarter, then you have Vasquez kind of getting you the points in the middle part of that game where, you know, the flow is still being figured. Then by the time you get to the fourth, you're in striking distance and, you know, either a crazy hot effort by a guy like Mason, or if Gordon and Anderson turn it on and close it out for you there, you get the win. But yeah, there is a lot of value going all the way back to Lopez getting you those points in the first quarter and Vasquez kind of in the muck in the middle of that game. So yeah, I do like that formula.
Yeah. I mean, the more I see this team playing together and this being the team that Dell actually envisioned, the more I'm liking it. But I mean, there's still clearly some holes that we need to fill. But, you know, I don't know. In this game, James Harden, I felt like Eric Gordon was defending him really well, and I feel kind of dumb saying that because he still scored 25 points on 18 shots. And, yeah, he took 41 minutes to do it, but that's a pretty nice game no matter how long it takes for you to do it. So did you feel like Eric Gordon was doing a good job on James Harden, or was I just, you know, enamored by a few plays where Gordon seemed to contest him really well?
No, I think that Gordon definitely forced him out of a lot of his comfort zones, kind of made him do, you know, just limited to one or two things. I mean, James Harden had 7 turnovers in this game. Like, that's huge. He got his points and he did it fairly efficiently, but if you consider those turnovers as possessions, so he had 25 points on 18 field goal attempts, but if you count those turnovers as field goal attempts, which essentially they should be, I mean, they should actually count more than a field goal attempt because you don't have a chance at an offensive rebound. But if you look at it as 25 possessions with Harden resulting in either a shot or a turnover, you know, only 25 points, I don't think it's a great game for him. And, you know, several of those buckets came in transition. A couple of them came against Austin Rivers, who I'll even say I think did a good job against Harden as well. It seems like the Hornets learned, you know, quite a bit by playing him, you know, just a short while ago. So, I thought Gordon did a really good job on Harden and really getting him out of his comfort zones, and more than anything, forcing him to where he had help. And that's where we saw Harden kind of running into players and losing the ball.
Yeah. Yeah, they were driving him to help, you know, especially when Jason Smith was there a lot more efficiently. But part of that was just because Jason Smith could hustle where he needed to get to. I mean, I don't know if we said enough about Jason Smith in this game. And I guess they said he was the MVP of it. So, the weirdest part about it was he was hurt. I mean, there was a couple, he got hit. His shoulder clearly was bothering him, and he wasn't even moving that arm for three or four plays after that happened.
Right.
Does that worry you at all?
No, I mean, I think he's used to it. I think he's a guy that gets limited minutes, so it's not going to keep wearing on him. But, yeah, I mean, ideally you would like him at 100%, but I just don't think that the style he plays at, you know, that we're going to see many games over the course of his career where, you know, he doesn't have some kind of nick or bang or bruise or sprain or, you know, contusion, something of that. So, you know, I kind of expect that. I love his toughness and getting up. And I think, you know, I think if anything, you know, seeing a guy play through injury, you know, is just as inspirational, and I think is just as much of a reason why these guys are kind of playing at the level they're playing. I mean, they have their team leader back. They have the guy who's been here the longest back, and, you know, kind of that source of inspiration in Jason Smith. I think he deserves a lot of the credit for this winning streak as well.
Yeah. All right, so you have anything to talk about before we get to games that are coming up?
I mean, just one other thing I noticed in this game. So 16 minutes, everybody will say, Mason, the three-point shooting put us over the top. But Roger Mason also grabbed 5 rebounds in this game. Yeah. And a lot of that has to do with Ryan Anderson. Ryan Anderson, I think, is smart enough to know when he can't box a guy out and get the rebound. You see this thing that Anderson's starting to do more and more now, where essentially he just boxes the guy out, but face-to-face boxing out, and just kind of pushes him out of the way, Ryan Anderson making no attempt to grab the rebound whatsoever, but just sealing that guy off, and then a guard dropping down and getting this rebound. So, mm-hmm. You know, you see a total of 12 offensive rebounds for Mason, Rivers, and Vasquez. Those guys aren't just killers on the boards that use their athleticism to go out and get them. I think a lot of those rebounds should somehow be put in Ryan Anderson's column, because essentially he's doing, you know, what he's being coached up to do. And, hey, you can't box out a physical specimen like Patrick Patterson and jump and get the rebound. That's all right. You just clear him out of the way, and I'll drop our guards down into that space, and they'll grab the board. And, you know, just another thing where stats don't tell the whole story. According to the stats, Roger Mason is just a monster rebounder in this game, you know, that would get 15 boards per 48 minutes. He's obviously not that kind of player. The reason that's happening is because of kind of this defensive strategy that guys like, you know, that the Hornets are imploring, because – frankly, Ryan Anderson is never going to be a fantastic defensive rebounder. But if he's doing this, he is doing his part on the defensive glass. So I just that really stood out to me in this game. So that was about it.
Okay. So coming up.
Well, before we move on, I got a mini ambush for you. I just want you, just based on what you've seen.
I'm not saying any more players' names.
No, just give me. I'm sorry. I don't mean to embarrass. But give me, I hope you didn't dig this deep into the stats, or even if you did, you didn't remember for your piece, which, again, I think everybody should read. Great piece that Ryan did today. He just pops him out of nowhere and does him whenever he feels like, and then goes back into his cave for a couple weeks. Right. But hopefully you didn't research this, but if you had to guess, by far the best five-man lineups, including Eric Gordon, there's two that just significantly stand out that, you know, are just leaps and bounds again beyond all the other five-man lineups that Eric Gordon has been in since his return. So there's two that are just exceptional. If you had to guess, what do you think those five-man lineups are?
Well, I think one of them has to be Smith, Anderson, Mason, Vasquez with Gordon. The other one, I would actually think it's Lopez, Anderson, Amino, Vasquez.
Interesting. So what was the second one you said?
Now you're going to challenge. Amino, Lopez, Anderson, Vasquez.
Amino, Lopez. Okay. So the best one by far, and now this is too small of a sample size. The other one is bigger. But the best one by far, just across the board, is the small ball one with Vasquez, Gordon, Eric, or Roger Mason, and then with Anthony Davis and Lopez in the front court. So that one, I mean, again, it's a small sample size, but, I mean, compared to all the other lineups, we're talking about plus 109 points per 100 possessions. Not 109 points per 100 possessions, but compared to the other lineups with – so we're talking about over 200 points per 100 possessions.
Yeah.
With that lineup. So, and but it kind of makes sense, and it's something that we talked about before of essentially putting Roger Mason at the small forward and spacing the court. You know, Robin Lopez and Anthony Davis, you would imagine combined provide obviously the size and some rebounding. So that is, again, a smaller sample size, but by far the best. And then the one with a fairly large sample size that comes in the best, this is actually the second most frequent unit that Gordon has played in, is Vasquez, Gordon, Al-Farouq Aminu, Ryan Anderson, and Robin Lopez.
That's what I said.
Yeah. So that, I mean, you were right on that one, and that's the one with, again, the biggest sample size that's playing really well. But I guess, so, I mean, basically what that's telling you is that, the holdovers are Vasquez and Lopez, and then the interchangeables are basically an exceptional rebounder and an exceptional three-point shooter. So, you know, in one lineup you have Mason and Davis, in the other one you have Anderson and Aminu. You know, surprisingly, we haven't seen really much of Anderson and Davis on the court together with Gordon to see how that would work. But it seems like at least the formula is the big body in Lopez to kind of clog up the lane and demand that defender, one three-point shooter, and then a fantastic defensive rebounder to kind of make up for, you know, the lack of rebounding that is in the lineup with Gordon, Lopez, and Vasquez. So,
right.
So it's interesting. So, I mean, I just think it bears out that if Davis can become that fantastic defensive rebounder over time, Anderson, obviously the three-point shooter, that really at small forward you could plug almost anything in there, and it looks like the Hornets would be fairly successful with that core of that lineup.
If you say Rudy Gay, I'm going to smack you.
Not Rudy Gay, but hey, he's on the trade market, and it looks like about eight different teams are interested. So,
I don't know what they're thinking. I mean, come on, is it not a red flag that the Memphis Grizzlies hire John Hollinger and the first thing that happens is Rudy Gay's put on the market?
I guess, unless you went the other way and said that, you know, the Grizzlies are going too far into advanced metrics, so let's try to take advantage of them here. No, I'm just saying that would be for the more old school GMs, whether they're right or wrong. I'm not saying they're right or wrong. I'm saying that I'm sure old school GMs' lips salivate when teams go to these advanced metrics and they say, well, I'll just take the guys who, with the eye test, play great basketball. So not saying which side is right, which side is wrong. I'm just saying that, you know, I don't think all the GMs are scared off by that. I think that they actually think this is a prime opportunity to take advantage of Memphis. So.
Yeah. Well, let's talk basketball for the rest of this week. On Friday, the Hornets will play host to Minnesota. And Sunday, they get to go visit New York, kicking off a 3-game road trip. So which of these two teams you want to talk about?
I'll let you go first.
I'll take New York. Or are you saying I need to take Minnesota?
You can take New York. So I didn't mean
to. You get to go first, I guess.
Okay. So Minnesota, I want to ask you this. I mean, I had a Twitter question from Nick Llewellyn, kind of ties into Minnesota. On the NBA on TNT show, Steve Kerr basically said that Aldridge is his pick for best power forward in the league. Barkley says it's Kevin Love over Blake Griffin. Obviously, Love is injured right now, but everybody's healthy. Who's the best power forward in the NBA?
Kevin Love.
All right. So, I mean,
I think Aldridge, I think that's a dumb pick.
That's Steve Kerr, and we could look at his draft record with the Phoenix Suns. So,
yeah, I mean, I don't even know where Aldridge comes from, because he's not a great rebounder and he takes really dumb shots. So that one's out of left.
Yeah, I think that's kind of from a coach's perspective, as far as, like, you know, who would be the hardest to defend. I think Aldridge is a tough cover. I just think he could shoot over anybody. He could play back to the basket or face up. I think purely if you're talking about, again, get away from the statistics, just who's the guy that's hardest to cover at the power forward position, I could see making the case for Aldridge.
I don't know. I'd probably make the case for LeBron James.
Oh, okay. Now he's a power forward? No, that's not fair.
But
anyway, so yeah, Kevin Love is going to be missing from this game again. With that hand injury, that all goes back to doing knuckle push-ups. I mean, I don't know why by now we have a Navy SEAL that invented it, why everybody isn't doing the perfect push-up. I don't get why we aren't at this point at a society where everybody just agrees to do the perfect push-up. Just a drastically different team without Kevin Love. I mean, it's funny because I think people think that this Kevin Love is going to hurt them just this year, but with Kevin Love off the court, Nikola Petkovic is putting up insane numbers. He might get a Roy Hibbert contract.
Yeah.
Like, his numbers are through the roof, especially when Love is off the court. He becomes, at the very least, their number one interior option with Love gone, and he might be, you know, just number one overall. I mean, nobody other than Love and Petkovic, nobody on this team averages double digit shots a game. Petkovic averages over 12.5. I mean, he's shooting almost three more shots than anybody else on this team. Next behind him is Luke Rednauer and Karolinko, but again, they're both just under 10. So, I mean, this team offensively is, you know, is going to be heavily reliant on a guy in Petkovic who is a nice complementary piece, but I don't think he's somebody that you're terrified or that you got to double team when he gets the ball down low, essentially you got to keep him off the glass where he gets about four a game and keep him from getting, you know, those easy putbacks. But I think with Love gone, this team becomes much easier to defend.
Yeah, I mean, Pekovic, I think Pekovic is like one of the funniest players around. Just like everything about him just screams like Eastern European kind of, you'd expect him after the game to be sitting there with a glass of vodka smoking a cigarette.
I think you're wrong on that one. I don't see him with a glass of vodka. I think he just drinks straight out of the
Right. Yes, I was giving him too much glass. But that's just a good, the feel, you know, he's sitting there with his vodka, his cigarette, and, you know, I mean, just glaring at people at a bar.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and because I think of just that's the impression he gives out there, I think he's underrated right now. But I think you're right. If he continues going this way and this team is on the playoff bubble with Kevin Love having been out and they continue to stay in the playoff bubble, I mean, I think he gets the Roy Hibbert kind of contract, which, and I think, honestly, I don't think he's going to be as bad as Hibbert this year, but I don't think he's ever going to pay it off. I mean, Marc Gasol got one like that, and he puts up similar numbers to Pekovic scoring-wise and rebounding-wise, but would you take Pekovic over Marc Gasol at all? I mean, even close?
So underrated, because people just look at, the Grizzlies run their whole offense through Marc Gasol.
Right. Like, yeah, I mean,
brilliant NBA player in ways that don't show up in the box score. Now, that is a guy who I would give a max paycheck to any day of the week. I think Pekovic gets one, doesn't necessarily deserve. I mean, I remember when we were talking about how he could be a great steal at $8 to $10 mil a year. That is just not happening.
Right. So I agree. Pekovic being the primary option isn't something to worry about. But I do think that the Hornets are still in a transition phase. They're working Eric Gordon in. I think they would be susceptible to a sort of team that moves the ball around a lot. And there are a lot of guys on this team who are capable of passing. Kirilenko is a good passer. Ridnour is a good passer. Shved's, well, maybe not good, but he's an adequate passer. Shved's a good passer. J.J. Barea, when he comes in, is a good passer. I mean, Ricky Rubio, he's not even going to play. But, I mean, they've got a bunch of different guys who can move the ball. And I think if the Hornets aren't careful, they can get picked apart. Do I think that's actually going to happen? No, I think the Hornets win this game.
So,
and I say Hornets by 6.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the offense doesn't, you know, the Minnesota offense doesn't worry me at all. Defensively, though, and you know, this was even without Kevin Love. They're playing exceptional in certain areas. I mean, they are number one in the entire NBA in defensive rebound percentage. And again, of course, you got to give a big part of that to Kevin Love. But they've played now half their games without Kevin Love. So it's not just him. I mean, Pekovic is a beast on the boards. Kirilenko rebounds like a power forward from the small forward position. Dante Cunningham is one of those guys that's severely underrated. I mean, he's a guy that I still always kind of wish that we had gotten. I mean, he was always out there for like a second round pick. You know, you could have got somebody like him over somebody like Xavier Henry, but you know, such is life. The Hornets big man position is fine, but yeah, they don't. Again, it's a similar recipe that we see with other good defensive teams. They don't foul you, and they control the defensive glass. So essentially, they're saying, if you could put up contested shots and make them, good for you, that's how you're going to beat us. But we're not going to beat ourselves by allowing you multiple chances or giving you, you know, shots at the free throw line. And you know, because of that, I could see this being a really ugly, low-scoring game. But if we stick to the formula that, you know, we've kind of seen recently, and Eric Gordon really is our closer, we have one and they don't. So, yeah, I agree. I'll say Hornets by 7.
Yeah. I think the only way that the Hornets will break this game open and win by a good margin, they give up a lot of three-pointers. They don't give up an incredible percentage, like about league average, but they let people have hit the sixth most number of threes against the Timberwolves in the league this year. So that could be it. If Ryan Anderson comes out and he's like, all right, I've had enough bad shooting, I'm going to just drill these people, and I think we could then see a runaway. But that's the only way I think we're going to run away from a team that's just solid defensively all around.
Yeah, it'll be nice. I mean, like I said, I remember looking at the January schedule and really thinking that it was going to be brutal, but now Kevin Love goes down. There's a game against the Lakers, and it seems like, you know, their entire team goes down. But one of our guys, Earl Clark, is coming up big for them. So, you know, we'll have to deal with Earl Clark. But the schedule is actually starting to break nice and gets really nice, really easy in February and March. So there could be a run. As for our next game, brought to you, and I mean, we've done Audible in the past. This game is brought to you by Honey Nut Cheerios. The New York Knicks. New York Knicks play the Hornets. Melo is not going to be suspended for this game, but it looks like Raymond Felton most likely will still be out. And this is a team that, I mean, it's surprising that an injury to Raymond Felton is what brings them down to earth. But, I mean, essentially, Felton has gone out. Amari Stoudemire has come in. And as many people suspected, this team has gotten worse.
Yeah. I mean, Amari Stoudemire, he's not playing a lot of minutes. I think he's averaging 20, and he's coming off the bench. But, I mean, Amari was terrible last year. There's not any way you can get around that. He takes too many jumpers now. His athleticism, I think he's 31. He's had multiple knee surgeries. He just doesn't have the explosion he used to have going on the pick and roll. He's basically become a pretty limited player. He never that great defensively. And he was never that great of a rebounder. And if you're not giving either of those things, and you're not really an efficient scorer anymore, you're a detriment to your team. So, I mean, Amari coming back, and I mean, this team had a crazy run at the beginning of the season, and there's no question about that. But part of it was because they had all these older guys who were coming in, and they were clicking, and they were shooting really well and playing really well. I mean, people just... It's the same sort of thing that was happening with the Dallas Mavericks and O.J. Mayo hitting all those shots. I mean, Jason Kidd was shooting something like 58% from three, a guy who has a career three-point percentage of like 36%. There's no way he's doing that for the rest of the season. And, I mean, J.R. Smith was shooting really well. At one point, I remember ESPN's Chris Palmer had like three games in a row where he's like, oh, J.R. Smith is still at 75% for the season. He's amazing. And I'm like, and you think that's going to exist? I mean, people were talking about this last game, the game that they just had against the Pacers. He had 25 points. J.R. Smith must be amazing, right? He took 29 shots in that game. I can't remember the last time the Hornets had a guy who took 29 shots. I mean, maybe David West pulled it off once.
And while you're on that Bucks score, can you read out Paul George's for our fans so people could stop, you know, posting any trades with Paul George coming back to the Hornets, because Indiana is never trading that guy.
24 points, 11 rebounds, 5 assists, 6 steals, 1 block, 1 turnover.
There was one point in the game where he was the leading scorer, leading assist guy, leading steal guy, and was only one rebound behind Tyson Chandler, like late in that game, like not for his team, but for everybody on the court. So please, 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 when we talk about possible trades or pickups for the Hornets, or when I write my missing piece and Paul George is not in there, don't think that there's any way that we could ever get that guy. Just wanted to get that out. But yeah, with the Knicks, what I will say in their defense, that they have kept up, and what I still do believe is a good formula for offensive performance, is they play a lot of isolation basketball and a lot of drive and kick. And when you do that, you're not going to turn the ball over. I mean, they still have the best turnover percentage in the NBA. And yeah, J.R. Smith and guys like that will chuck, but, you know, they're not creating a lot of turnovers. I mean, turnovers are created when you try to fit balls in small space in the passing lane. When you attack the basket out of control and pick up charges. I mean, really, they are an isolation team, and settle for shots that we don't think are great, or they'll drive and kick out to 3-point shooters. But there has to be something that is said for not turning the ball over and at least getting a shot off on almost every possession.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, I will say this about their team. They do a really good job of spreading the floor and nailing their shots. Even those ISO, if somebody does get double-teamed, they're pretty good at moving the ball. I mean, Carmelo for years has been called a selfish player, and I still think in a lot of ways he's fairly selfish. But if he gets double-teamed, he moves the ball. And they do a really good job of capitalizing on that. The one thing that I want to see more than anything else, just like I did in the last time against San Antonio, this is the one thing I want to see them do in this. There was an article that came out like 2 days before the last New York Knicks game when the Hornets played them. And they highlighted that the number one offensive move that Carmelo Anthony pulls off that he is absolutely deadly at is a one facing up, then taking a one dribble left or one dribble right and pulling up and jumping. And he was shooting like 59% from that mid-range shot. And he was also getting fouled like crazy on it. And we watched him turn on Al-Farouq in that game, and his first four possessions were one dribble left or one dribble right, and he hit every single one of them. And if you remember right, Carmelo Anthony was unstoppable in that game.
No, and he was stoppable by one person. Lance Thomas did a really good job.
That's true. Lance Thomas did a good job on him. And the way he did that was he bodied him. As soon as Carmelo turned up face, Lance was right up under him. And Farouk would give him a little room respecting his drive. And that's what allowed him to have that room to do the one dribble pull up. So I just want to see the Hornets not give up those one dribble pull ups. Make Anthony put it on the ground. And he's also very good. If he's moving against you, puts it on the ground, goes to the basket, and does a spin, he can finish those shots. But his most efficient shot is the one dribble pull-up. Stop it.
Yeah.
Make him do something else.
Yeah, to me, these are the type of games, just matchup-wise, that scare me because, again, of how the Knicks play. I mean, defensively, they make a lot of high-impact plays. They're number one in the NBA in steals, number two in blocks. And those things get teams out to transition. They don't turn it over themselves. Like, this is a game where I could very easily – we said that the number one reason why the Hornets beat the Spurs is because they took 10 more shots. I feel like we could be saying the exact same thing of this is why the Knicks beat the Hornets. They took 10 more shots than we did in this game. It's just – to me, for the way that the Hornets play, I hate going against teams that are exceptional in high impact areas. I still think this game will come down to which J.R. Smith the Hornets wind up playing, but just don't have as good of a feeling about this game as I do against other matchups.
So your prediction?
I got... I'll take the Knicks by 9. I think this is, we'll be excited going into this game, winning streak, Knicks not playing so well, expecting another win, and, this is where a little bit of a reality check is dealt.
Yeah, I actually had Knicks by 14.
Wow.
Yeah, I think they're going to smack us.
All right.
So hopefully we're wrong again. Last week we both predicted one loss, one win. Different games, but we still have the same prediction. Or that last podcast. So this time we're basically both saying we're going to, win one and then drop one. So we'll see. Hopefully we'll have another 2-0 week. Or in Michael McNamara's case, he wants an 0-2 week.
No.
Because he likes to be on the losing end of things.
No.
He's a loser.
I am a little tired of losing, but I do want to win. I'm still stuck in that battle. At this point, if you were to tell me that Gordon is going to play for the rest of the year, I want to win as many games as possible. My thing is always that, of course, I think Gordon's going to miss another huge chunk. So I just don't want to be in that area where we win with him, then he's out again and lose, and then don't get a good pick. But I am actually, you know, my missing piece this week is all about kind of ranking the tiers of the NBA draft prospects to give us an idea of, you know, what kind of pick could get a substantial player. Because, I mean, as of right now today, the Hornets would have the number 3 pick in the draft, but they're only a couple of games away from shooting all the way up to, or I guess down to 11.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, Philadelphia right now would have the number 11 spot, and the Hornets are just a handful of games behind them. I mean, if we're talking about a significant winning streak, we're talking about the difference between a top 3 pick and a, you know, an end of lottery pick. So to put it in perspective, a Brad Beal or a Damian Lillard versus an Austin Rivers. So
you had to make that pick, didn't you?
Sorry.
You could have, like, you know, been nice and said, you know, Myers Leonard.
Yeah, because he's phenomenal. Because Portland fans, they're excited about their future, not because of Lillard, but because of Myers Leonard.
Absolutely. No, like, they could sell Lillard any day.
Yeah, but I mean, luckily, the tiers in this draft, at least the way I see it, break a little differently, so I don't anticipate it being that substantial. So, long story short, we can root for wins. Yay!
Woohoo! All right, so thanks everybody for listening to In the Know. Look forward to his draft piece. I know I'm always a fan of draft pieces, whether we're picking high or low.
I'll just do Rudy Gay part 2, never mind.
Thanks for listening.